Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the 21st century hold for the descendants of those slaughtered by the U.S. cavalry at Wounded Knee Creek in 1890? While that massacre remains the most chilling example of what the Oglala Lakota people suffered as a result of federal action, well over a century later, the legacies of displacement and broken promises remain. The suicide and infant mortality rates are high, addiction is common, and poverty is rampant. But as my guest today will tell us, there is a bright glimmer of hope dawning on the Pine Ridge Reservation as residents rediscover traditional values and culture and feel more empowered than they have in generations to chart the course of their own futures. Journalist Alexandra Fuller's article, In the Shadow of Wounded Knee, is the cover story for the current issue of National Geographic magazine. Alexandra, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start by reviewing a bit of the history of Wounded Knee and the Oglala Lakota. In 1890, the area was the site of one of the most notorious incidents of genocide in the history of this country. What led up to that?
It was a mixture of a hysterical reaction on the part of the U.S. government to this upsurge in spiritual access to the ancestors on behalf of the Lakota, as best I can say it. I mean, it's such a deep story, so that I'm giving an absolute glass of it. But they began to get very jumpy about the upswing in this thing known as the ghost dance, where the Lakota communed profoundly with their ancestors. And I think from the very beginning, the U.S. government realized that the biggest threat to them with regard to Indians of any sort was their access to their spirituality. It's an incredibly empowering thing to have your spirituality and your culture intact. So a ban was sort of put on these ghost dances, a band led by the chief Bigfoot, also known as Spotted Elk, left as a result of a sort of massacre and blowout, and was on his way to Pine Ridge to commune with other leaders to discuss how best to keep their culture and spirituality intact. The 7th Cavalry of the U.S. Army got, I think it's fair to say, sort of touchy about this movement of people, including many women and children, open fire one winter day, and it was an out-and-out massacre of women and children. And many listeners will remember that iconic photograph of the chief lying in the snow with his hand sort of reaching for the air in this kind of distorted grope into the future. It's the most chilling photograph. If you go to the massacre site now, to the mass grave there, it's an incredibly somber, sort of spiritually heavy place. And the thing that I have written is that if you go there and sort of stand and contemplate what happened on that day, it's easy to believe that certain energies, acts of tremendous violence, for example, can hang in the air forever and possess a forever half-life.
And you talk about the fact that for the Oglala Sioux, time isn't something that they conceive of in a linear fashion because of their spirituality, and that sort of has an impact on the way you look at deaths that are happening there now.
And I think, I mean, the first thing I want to say is I'm by no means qualified to speak on the behalf of a whole people. This is I think that's one of the tricky things going in as a writer into this just unbelievably deep, unbelievably beautiful, sometimes baffling and alarmingly gorgeous spirituality. It's a very physical spirituality. It's very connected to ancestors and spirits and the natural world in a way that I'm not even sure we have the vocabulary for. And in the same way, I'm not sure that we have the vocabulary necessarily to describe time the way that it's understood in the Lakota sense. And the best that I could come at it was that time was circular. And I think we make the mistake and have made the mistake coming in as outsiders to see current lives on reservations across this country as a failed attempt at being our culture, instead of understanding that Indian culture is in of itself its own strong standing structure that we don't have the vocabulary to explain. And once I understood that and was able to think of time as something circular and think of ancestors and spirits as being something that aren't the way that necessarily in Western culture we bury our dead, and that's kind of the end of it. You know, we may have a few photos of our ancestors lurking around, but it's not like we commune with them as a matter of course, or that we have this deep, deep connection with our past that is no different from our connection with the future. It's a very mind-bending place to be. And I would often feel when I was on the reservation and leaving it, I began to say, I'm going back to the States. Mm. I felt distinctly as if I was in a different world. And by the end of my summer on the reservation, I could almost feel the invisible membrane, that membrane through which I was passing to come back to the States, where time is this linear thing, where we have a very concrete concrete belief in time, which, of course, is invisible, became more ridiculous for me the longer I was on the reservation.
It is interesting because I think that for Americans who have not spent a lot of time on reservations, we recognize that Indian nations are separate sovereign nations, but a lot of people sort of don't get the concept of how different life there is.
I also think that there was, a really strong prejudice when I would come off the reservation and explain that I had been on Pine Ridge was they, which is always a red flag for me that we have now crossed into that territory of forgetting our common humanity. They are living off federal government welfare, and didn't we beat them in the Indian Wars? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was very telling for me was being at the Gathering of Nations. And by the way, I use the word Indian advisedly. It is what most of the Lakota and most of the people I interviewed would self-identify as Indians. They would consider it actually a bit of an insult to be called indigenous. They say, we know we were here first. We don't need to be labeled as something separate, which is so why I use that term. But at, for example, the Gathering of Nations, there were many people wearing T-shirts that says the Indian Wars were never over. And what I think most U.S. citizens forget, and it's, you know, I'm sure true in Canada too, where, by the way, Indian populations do not consider that border a border. For them, the whole of the North American continent exists as an island of which they are a part. But they would, they would argue that they made treaties with the U.S. government that ensured that they would have some entitles and benefits in perpetuity, and that the U.S. government broke almost every single treaty with the Indian nations, and that those treaties are still alive and well and kicking, and that there needs to be compensation and redress. And so this, and for example, on Pine Ridge, there isn't a sort of monthly check from a government. That those prejudices that exist beyond the borders of reservations are shocking and widespread. And I think based on a very real fear that if we were going to address the injustices of the last 120 years, that there's going to have to be more than just an unbinding apology, a non-binding apology, which is what was finally issued in 2010, that there would have to be a fair looking at the treaties and the ways in which those were broken.
And in fact, the land in the Black Hills had been granted to them by the Fort Laramie Treaty in 1868, but that was before the federal government realized how much gold there was in the area.
Correct. It's amazing how shifty those treaties become with the discovery of wealth. And in 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court actually upheld the Laramie Treaty and granted the Sioux Nations that, yes, that land had belonged to them, and that there was a compensation of some over a million you know, for that land, which would have been the cost of the land at the time plus interest. And the response from the Sioux Nation, of which the Lakota are part, was the Black Hills are not for sale. It is their access mundi. It is the absolute heart of the Sioux spirituality from, you know, from what I gather. And again, I'm not speaking as an Indian, so this is based on my interviews and so on. And I think that what was, once I understood that, and I actually drove through the Black Hills with a young medicine woman and her two children, and I felt for the first time the absolute shocking insult of Mount Rushmore, that for Native American cultures or Indian cultures, to have your most sacred place and your grandfather spirits, which those incredibly beautiful rock faces are, blown up and carved into the image of the founding fathers, is a calculated insult that for which I actually didn't have the vocabulary to describe. I couldn't imagine what an equivalent insult would be.
Was it helpful to you, Alexandra, as someone who was not born in the United States, to come in and get to know these people and try to tell their story to the extent that you didn't maybe represent all of U.S. culture?
Well, I don't feel as if I represent any culture, which I think is a lucky thing. I think that really is one's job as a writer. I am a U.S. citizen, and I'm proud and I'm grateful for what this country stands for, which is to uphold religious freedoms and to uphold our freedom of speech. Those two things are absolutely sacrosanct to me. I come from Zimbabwe, where those rights are not granted to the people, and I am such a staunch believer in it. I think that in a funny way, it's given me the courage to go forward as a writer. But that authority behind me, it's an astonishing authority. I think if you have grown up with it, it isn't such a startling daily gift as it is if you come at it afresh. So what's amazing to me and what's so broken for me is that actually Indian culture was banned from expressing its spirituality until the 1970s. It wasn't until the 1970s that Congress finally acknowledged that Indian spirituality could be expressed. I found that shocking. And I found it shocking that in the U.S., where we so value sovereignty and we so value the right to protect and stand on our land, the lands on the reservation are administered by the Bureau of Indian Affairs out of Washington, D.C. I mean, this is an absolute anathema to everything that we individual U.S. citizens stand and believe for. And so we really, Indians are treated as wards of the state, of the federal government, and as children. Mm. They aren't allowed a deep autonomy on their land, as is granted by treaties and recognition of the federal government. And I think that what really shocked me, and I'm sure I will get into enormous trouble for saying this, I grew up in southern Africa, north of the Limpopo River, not in South Africa. And actually, the last time I spoke to you, I had just come back from South Africa and seen a very similar situation where indigenous populations were pushed into tribal trust lands, very like reservations, and their rights were taken away.
My guest is journalist Alexandra Fuller. Her article, rather, in the August 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine is called In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. You can join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Thank on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Alexandra Fuller. She wrote the cover story for the current issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. You can join this conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Alexandra, how did the Oglala Lakota manage to preserve their spiritual practices after a century of being on the wrong side of the law? And what has changed since the law, in fact, acknowledged their right to practice?
This was one of the most moving experiences of being on the reservation, was the powerful shift of sort of physical self, even when the elders who had access, still great access to the language and to their spirituality, would go from speaking English into speaking Lakota. I mean, it is just such a soft, gorgeous, beautiful language. And I was interviewing someone who I called an elder, and he objected and said, I am a robust Lakota man. But he had said his father had been beaten to death by cowboys in Gordon, Nebraska, when he was a boy. He had raised his brothers and sisters. His name's Alex Whiteplume. He's, for a long time, been an Indian activist, a member of the American Indian Movement. And he said to me, you know what has stopped me from being a cold-hearted murderer? And I said, no, I can't imagine. His insults and injuries go back so far. He had three of his ancestors killed at Wounded Knee. He lives on the land through which Wounded Creek runs, Wounded Knee Creek runs. And he said, my language is so gentle and beautiful. In it, we don't have the kinds of words that allow for the sorts of hatreds that would make me a murderous person. And the same with the spirituality is so encompassing. Now, there was only so much access to the spirituality I had, because the profound Lakota spirituality is shut off to outsiders, which I think is fair enough for a number of reasons. One was that for so long it was forced underground, and to keep those traditions, I think, as pure as possible, the Lakota feel compelled to keep it secret. And second, you know, there would be a wave of sort of new agey type people who flood into the reservations during the Sundance season and are kind of, I think, slightly titillated by these amazing ceremonies where men and women dance under the hot sun for hours and hours, for days in a row, and then the men will affix themselves to a specially chosen sacred cottonwood tree that has been carried to the center of the Sundance, and they affix themselves with ropes and buffalo pegs to their chest. They actually pierce their chest, and they dance from this tree, attached to the tree, until they can break themselves loose from it. And it's a profound act of thanksgiving and of, as far as I could understand, a sort of sacrifice for the greater humanity. I mean, these are not sort of trivial spiritual celebrations. It's a very physical access to that world. And to think that those were driven underground for so long, and that a few medicine men chose to hold on to those traditions and to keep them. And one of the greatest ways in which the U.S. government, either inadvertently or very cunningly, sought to kind of eliminate the Lakota and many of the Indians from the face of our continent was to take away their language. So there was, for a long time, forced boarding schools for children where you were beaten for speaking your own language. And without access to that language, access to your culture and spirituality diminishes in a way that we don't have in English. For example, Alex Whiteplume, the elder about whom I was speaking, said that really in Lakota there's no word for forgiveness. That if you have done something and you were conscious at the time of doing it, then you did that thing deliberately and you are responsible for the action of that. Now, how that would feature into your whole worldview is unimaginable to us, because I think we really hold on to words like forgiveness. We want to be able to have a clean slate, and our Christian belief really hangs on, our Judo-Christian tradition really hangs on this idea of forgiveness. And I think the other thing that I didn't understand, and this was a very chilling deja vu back to my work in South Africa, was when I learned that all tribal members are required to carry a card that indicates to within a drop of blood what ethnicity they are.
Hmm.
For example, one young man I met was 7/8 Lakota and an 1/8 Irish, thanks to a Pony Express rider who had gone through, you know, the reservation in the 1860s. And another woman that I interviewed was 7/16 Lakota and then a mix of other tribes from Arizona. But these are broken down on a card that these people carry around with them. And this hyper-awareness of one's blood is so reminiscent of apartheid-era obsession with race. And, of course, it coincides with this idea of having separate areas for indigenous people, you know, so that newcomers can come and take over the country. And one of the other things that I didn't realize was that you cease to become an Indian when your blood drops below 1/4. So it makes for this very strange, imposed, in-looking self, where in order to survive as a culture, you have to marry within your own group. And think about what that would do for you psychologically. And this was something I hadn't understood. And hadn't realized before. I can't imagine how the rest of the U.S. population would react if we were required to carry a card that said to within a drop of blood what our ethnicity was in order to sort of justify where we lived and how we lived.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone with Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, I was wondering if you got into Black Elk. I had read him in the 90s, and he sort of comes to mind now as I think we might be looking at a change in our empire, and on those terms, I wonder about the British. And you have an interesting parallel with us and our colonial heritage. We tell ourselves we're the colonized, but of course we were the colonial. We were colonialists who broke away from the motherland. Anyway, all that's seems very interesting and modern, you know, and appropriate for us today. But just wondering what you know, if he's still alive for them and the tough lesson he had to impart for his people.
I think that is a really good question on a lot of levels. Well, of course, you know, I did a lot of reading, particularly before I went on the reservation because, you know, I'm not even from the continent, I felt as if I was starting on the back foot slightly. What I was astonished to learn was that the Lakota that I spoke to, in any case, don't hold up any leader as a voice the way that we do. For example, you know, we have George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and that kind of thing, and we, as U.S. citizens, we constantly revert back to our founding fathers, and they become in the way of celebrity. Now, what the elders explained to me when I was on the reservation, that this idea of Black Elk or Crazy Horse, with some of the great Lakota leaders, are a completely Western construct.
Hmm.
That for the Lakota, you as a human being, and this was just one of the most beautiful things that I sort of understood, particularly as it referred to masculine spirituality, that as a male you're born, you get a sort of nickname, like Worm, for example, was Crazy Horse's name. You are really sort of diminished, and you then grow up old enough to do your vision quest, your Humbletcha, and you go out and sent under very harsh conditions to go and live under the sun for 3 days with no food, no water, and to be humbled. What the prayer was when I was in the ceremony before these young men were sent on vision quests, in this burning hot sun, I have to say, it was over 100 degrees, and the elders put them in a place where there may be no shade, no food, no water. They pray that their boys will come back, men humbled as a piece of grass, and that in that they will be as both diminished and as powerful as it's possible to be, because a blade of grass can be crushed by the foot of a child, but it can be eaten by a bison and become one of the most powerful beings. As a Lakota man goes through his sort of cycle of life as warrior and protector, and holder of great spiritual understanding, as he becomes an old man, he sheds that off again and becomes, as an elder, the humble, humble thing that he was as a baby. To somehow freeze that cycle in a place where your words and your ideas and your ideology and your sense of celebrity are stuck and something that everyone has to adhere to is a Western construct. It's not something that the Lakota understand. And that, for me, became one of the ways where I felt as if I was stepping between two worlds, this invisible but very powerful membrane that I was talking about, that for us to write and think about the Lakota in the English language, even that begins to be a bit of an assault. And to think about it in terms of our culture becomes a bit of an assault. And I think, you know, I'm of British origin, and I come from colonizing parents and grandparents, and I think that it was rung very true for me, this idea that, you know, the British very strongly felt that if you weren't British, you were just a failed attempt at being British, and if you would just relax and let, you know, the British colonize you, everything was going to work out well for you. Well, you know, the vast majority of colonizing Americans didn't believe that. There was a civil war, and you know, the rest is, as we say, history. And yet we, as U.S. citizens, are now reluctant to understand that about the population that was here before we arrived, and that would include me. I think that's also something the Lakota said, is, listen, I don't care if you came here yesterday or if your ancestors came here on the Mayflower. That makes no difference to us. You're still on the land that was historically ours. Those treaties are still broken.
You write about a young woman who's had quite a troubled past, but is really emerging as a sort of community and also a spiritual leader. And she says that it's a daily struggle for each and every one of us to be fully Lakota. Can you talk about what you understood her to mean by that?
It took me a while, I have to say, to really grasp that to be Lakota is to fully encompass that as a confusing and tricky problem, because you have to understand yourself as belonging to bigger than the borders of your reservation, and to be being more than just the sum of your, you know, the way that you're seen, or, you know, your addictions, your poverty, and those sorts of things. And it only really became clear to me when I understood. Her name was Olowan Thunderhawk Martinez. And so Martinez talks about we have, as culture, as resistance. In other words, if you can hold on to your Lakota culture, being cramped in these housing and urban development homes, which are filled with black mold, which are very, very violent, crushed little places, these little villages. When you step out of that and belong to your own culture, where you come away from sort of food stamps and people dumping their used clothes by the ton on the reservation and bringing their sort of religious gospel to you and that sort of thing, when you step back into your culture, you already have everything within you that you need to heal yourself from what the Lakota would call their genocidal wounds, their historic wounds. And this was in my head, and I could cerebrally maybe understand it, but I didn't get a heart, sort of soul understanding of it until Alex Whiteplume, the elder that I had spoke to, said to me, you know, everything in the U.S. is designed around money. So how do we live in that mode with the white man's house, the white man's pickup, the white man's currency, and still keep our traditional Lakota culture, which would reject the way that we accumulate individual wealth and the way that we separate ourselves from community, the way that the walls around our house separate us from not only other people in, you know, our neighbors and our country, but also from our ancestors. And so the closer that the Lakota can adhere to their spirituality, the more immunity they have against the sort of oppressive epidemics that come with their history, which is alcoholism and this awful rampant sexual abuse and violence, and, you know, school dropout, drug use, gangs, those sorts of things which become endemic in cultures and populations that have lost a sense of their own selves.
Talk about that for a moment a little more, because I think there are people from outside cultures that are racially oppressed or financially beleaguered who say, okay, there has been injustice, there has been abuse, but a lot of people on the outside fail to see that there is any sense of people who have these problems taking responsibility for themselves. And it doesn't sound like that was your experience, but can you talk about that?
Yeah, and I think that this is a really rough part of being on the res, and it's something that you really experience when you're out there. You would see the most atrocious alcoholism and violence, and on the other hand, you see these dedicated medicine men and elders keeping the ceremonies alive, and then as Sundance season approaches, literally scores and scores and scores of Lakota going to these private, beautiful, profound ceremonies, being pierced during their ceremonies. And it's so widespread. I was doing a drive around with a tribal policeman one night, the 8 to 4 o'clock in the morning shift, 8 at night, 4 o'clock in the morning, which is where you witness some of these sort of things that we talk about, not being able to take responsibility for yourselves. And the cop is wearing a bulletproof vest, and he kept sort of shifting around rather uncomfortably. And I finally said to him, you know, that thing must be awfully hot. He said, no, it's not that. I just was at my yearly Sundance, and I pierced. Hmm. And the stars rub against the bulletproof vest. And if he comes across a terrible drunk driving accident, for example, and people have died at the scene, he said to me, you know, for me, it's very important as a Lakota, but as a policeman and as a member of this community, to leave gifts and offerings to that departing spirit. The connection is perpetual, it's amazing, and it was something that moved me incredibly deeply.
My guest is journalist Alexandra Fuller. She wrote the cover story for the current issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. You can join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the author of the cover story of this month's National Geographic magazine, In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. It's journalist Alexandra Fuller. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Zabaria in Grapevine. Hi, Zabaria.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I was basically calling because I've always been very curious about the Indian history, and as a historical studies major, I've been provided very limited information. So I've been concerned why it's been kept out of the norms of education, and also I'm going to be a high school teacher, so as a future educator, that increases my concern for the censorship. Also,
yeah.
I'm a religious minority, so it's really frightening when Native Americans or Indians haven't been able to get their rights to the full extent. I really worry for everybody else.
Hmm. What do you think, Alexandra?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and I think there's a wonderful saying by an Aboriginal activist, Lilla Watson, who says, if you've come here to help me, don't waste your time. But if you've come here because your liberty is inextricably bound up with mine, then come, let's work together. And I think that we have lost that piece of this very important connection, whether you're a religious minority, and we see what's just happened, awful massacre of the Sikh community in Wisconsin, or we see the rights of Indians being ignored for decades. And I think one of the reasons why this issue is absent from our history books is that it's a very shameful legacy that the U.S. has. And it's not something that has been adequately addressed. And it, as I've said before, it wasn't until 2010 that there was an even official but non-binding government apology to the indigenous people for the atrocities committed against them, which included genocide and removal of their language and this awful widespread abuse of Indians when they went to these boarding schools. A lot of the Indians came out of the boarding schools having been sexually abused, physically abused. And notice it was an apology. That's it. It wasn't a promise to redress the past or to honor the treaties that have been broken or to offer restitution. And I think that this is a really uncomfortable thing for most U.S. citizens to confront. And the mainstream history books do a good job of brainwashing us into thinking that Indian wars took care of the indigenous population and that the U.S. government sort of quote-unquote won, and that the Native American population is irrelevant in ancient history. And I also think that the way that Indians are written about in mainstream culture as being, you know, oppressed and alcoholics and poverty-stricken and this kind of amorphous mess is one way to keep the issues of Indians at a very arm's length, that we can now keep saying us and them instead of a conversation that allows for our common shared humanity and our common shared history. I mean, whether we like it or not, we share a violent, troubled history, and it is our first and most broken relationship. And one of the things that I also write about, and I can't emphasize this enough, and I had a very difficult time writing about it, and I'm finding it hard to speak about because I don't think our language is adequate for it. But one of the things that Olowun Thunderhawk Martinez aimed to do, she had been an alcoholic, she'd been sexually abused, she got thrown in jail for distributing drugs, where she was sober for the first time in her life, and she began to have visions and messages from the ancestors that said, you've got to go back to your absolute essential Lakota roots, that the closer you get to that, the more powerful you will become. And so when she came out of prison, one of the things that she did was she set up a teepee on her mother's land, and for a while lived off as close to lived off the land as she could. Now, by U.S. conventional Western mores, Martinez's vision would seem unambitious to the point of meaningless because we measure, our measurements are different. In other words, one of the things that you said earlier, Chris, is, you know, why don't the Lakota take responsibility for themselves, by which we mean, why don't they behave more like us? Why don't they want a mortgage and health insurance and, you know, retirement funds, and why don't they want to live like us? Well, it's the wrong question to ask. It's what power do the Lakota have within their own spirituality, within their own culture, to live the way they choose to live? And the messiest people that I met on the res, in terms of drug addiction and abuse and that kind of thing, were the most liminal. In other words, the people who the Lakota called them Hollywood Indians, the ones that sort of show up at the end of the credits kind of thing. The very powerful, most spiritually, most intact people on the reservation were very, very difficult to reach for very good reason. They wanted very little to do with me, and they were hard to access, and I really respected that, and actually the longer I was there, the more I understood why. And so, you know, I think that we are using the wrong measurement to understand what responsibility looks like. Are you responsible the more, quote-unquote, like a white man you behave, like a U.S. citizen you behave, or are you responsible the more Lakota you behave? Never forgetting that Indians demographically make up a disproportionately high percentage of our armed forces, by the way.
Yeah.
So it's not as if that doesn't occur, too. I mean, this isn't a black and white story. This isn't without its contradictions. This isn't without a stunning, these sort of stunning realizations. You go to any powwow, and you will see more veterans than you do at any, you know, mainstream U.S. rodeo or that kind of thing. These people who are incredibly proud to have served their people in protection of their land. That amazed me that on the one and the very self-same people who are the most outspoken American Indian movement activists, people like Alex Whiteplume, have also served in our military. And so it's this, we can't have an us and them conversation. I think that's where we break down and revert to the beginning. We just keep coming back to the beginning instead of allowing a circular conversation and open dialogue.
Well, you know, this idea of differing notions of connections across cultures, across generations, is interesting to me because it goes back to what you were saying about the fact that that Lakota have no word in their language for forgiveness because once an act is committed, it stays. On the other hand, I think sort of westernized European Americans can look back sort of dispassionately at what took place and say, that's horrible, but that had nothing to do with me, and not sort of feel those connections.
Well, of course, but and also in part because it's a lot more convenient and a lot less uncomfortable,
right,
to have that point of view and to say, hey, the Indian wars are over, we're standing on this soil, this is all good. It's all good for whom, though? And that it also completely ignores what I saw, and again, I really just want to emphasize, I'm so not speaking on behalf of the Indian people. I mean, I'm speaking on behalf of what I saw as a writer. But one of the most amazing ceremonies that I was able to witness was the one in which we were in a sweat lodge, a purification lodge, they call it, where it's very physical spirituality. You're in a dark, covered sort of womb, really, and you sit in a circular. Again, so much to do with Indian culture has to do with being in a circular, the sense that the infinite, it's an infinite game. You aren't in a game to win. That would be a finite game, and then it's the end. This idea of the infinite, this idea of the connection with the past. And these two young boys are about to be sent out for their 3 days, and the elder, it's scorching hot in this purification lodge, and the elder passes a ladle of cold water around as we're praying for these young men, and he says to all of us, but particularly to them, remember the sip of water. When you're out on the hills, remember that you're only as strong as your need for one sip of water. Remember that you're nothing more than that. And it is incredible to know that right on our, within us, within our own country, there is a culture that honors humility, that really understands the value of knowing your exact place on earth, that without a sip of water, we're nothing. It's such a reversal of the very sort of go-get-em, winner-takes-all culture of our mainstream, where we're, you know, where we're about winning, where we're about extracting resources. Without that kind of humility, without understanding that without our aquifers, without rainfall, we will be reduced to the sum of the sip of water that we wish we could have. And I think that, I mean, it was one of the things that I kept feeling when I was out there, that, gosh, in some time, maybe not very far into the future, the mainstream will be looking more and more to indigenous people, to intact indigenous wisdom, and saying, how is it again that we are to live in harmony with the soil? Because I think, frankly, we've done a really lousy job of it over the last couple of hundred years.
We have an email here from Dee who writes, please remind your listeners that your guest is speaking about a very specific piece of Native American life, Lakota. The Lakota are only one of thousands of tribes in this country. To be Indian varies from one tribe to another. Each culture is unique, has unique and specific spiritual ceremonies. The Lakota get more mainstream coverage than other tribes, mostly because of Black Elk Speaks. Wounded Knee Massacre is symbolic for all nations and tribes in the sense that natives have been abused and stifled across this country. To be Indian today in the U.S. is very challenging. I get upset when conversations venture into generalizations.
I would absolutely agree with that, and that has not been an uncommon response to this piece. And you know, I think that, again, I'd like to make it clear, I'm not even speaking for the Lakota, let alone the greater Indian experience at all. But the one thing that felt true to me, and really, perhaps again, I'm wrong here because I'm coming from the outside, but in the 1970s. The greater Indian community themselves chose Pine Ridge as the sort of ground zero for resistance. And so they occupied Wounded Knee And it was that, I don't know if listeners would remember this, but it was a pivotal moment in the American Indian movement where natives from across the nation occupied Wounded Knee as the symbolic resistance. It was a standoff for over 3 months. Thousands of shells were fired. Murder rates on Pine Ridge in the subsequent years went up to the highest in the nation. It led to the imprisonment, life imprisonment of American Indian Movement leaders. And so one of the things that struck me was, and the emailer is absolutely correct, that this is just one fraction and that these generalizations are very dangerous. And that is the danger, I think, of having an hour-long conversation about this as opposed to what we really need, which is a deeper, wider conversation, including the voices of Indian people. But that the American Indian Movement, for a moment in the 70s, came together in a way that often when I was on the res, people would speak about how in the 60s the civil rights movement came together, that people of color understood that unless they joined together as one people, they would be less powerful than if they did join behind a common cause. And so there was this famous occupation of Wounded Knee, but also American Indian Movement activists marched on D.C., and it became a powerful moment to which the Indian nations in general, and again, I'm sort of nervously using that word, but they speak about at the Gathering of Nations, for example, at the powwow that I went to in Pine Ridge. But I would absolutely agree with that. This is one of hundreds of nations.
We have just less than a minute left, but for those of us who really want to understand and enhance our knowledge, if we are not necessarily, for a variety of good reasons that you've outlined here, welcome to sort of go visit these people, these places, how do we enhance our sense of connection with Native peoples in the United States and feel as if their history is our history?
I think that there's a great deal of reading to be done, and to try and understand the Lakota perspective, I think Black Elk Speaks is a good start, although I think one needs to be constantly aware that there are more than one stories. But I think Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee should be required reading. I think that people should understand the Trail of Tears, and I think that there are indigenous communities dotted around this country, some bigger, some smaller, that I would not necessarily at all say that you're unwelcome to go there. You're unwelcome to go there with your cultural prejudice. But you're not. I never, ever, for a single moment, felt unwelcome on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. I felt invisible sometimes, but I never felt unwelcome. And when I asked questions, and some of them were incredibly stupid and came, again, from a place of prejudice and ignorance, I found that people were unbelievably patient and really wanted to have this dialogue.
I have to jump in here for time's sake. Alexandra Fuller's article in National Geographic is called In the Shadow of Wounded Knee. Alexandra, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Get the free podcast online at kera.org/think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.